We've got Mr. Berman here. We'll be speaking to him. He's in, as you've heard, in Mexico. Bear with us should we have a break in the connection, at which point we'll try to reconnect with our guests, and we'll also take their time to remind you about becoming a member. Just a little bit about how we got, how this book was chosen. A little while ago, we had Walter Davis, who wrote Death's Kingdom. And he was a person who also kind of touched briefly upon, touched on this same topic. It basically came about for me doing some travels this year and noticing just a little bit of a difference in the way I saw people responding to both authority and to each other and to the challenges of travel around us. And people seem to be in a strangely compliant state, I'd noted, when we're at the airport. A little hypnotic, you know, and it's really disconcerting when you see your fellow human beings walking about in much what you might say kind of a quieted herd mentality. I think much more of us than that. And when I see people moving along a little too complacently, compliantly, and not really using any real common sense, it kind of distressed me. I was also watching people not aware of threats when we're walking in the Grand Canyon and they had a freak hailstorm came up and people are running up and down the paths. And you're thinking, have people lost the concept of danger, and have they lost that basic human connection? So I had a conversation with Cecil and Kathleen. We did some checking, and I found two authors that I thought really spoke to that and who I want to have a conversation with to find out what has been our mindset since at least 9/11, perhaps even a little earlier. And Walter Davis and Morris Berman were two of the authors who came up. Now, if you've had a chance to read any of the books by Morris Berman, you'll find him not only to be basically a very thoughtful person, but talks about some of the more optimistic aspects of life, such as the reenchantment of the world or coming to our senses, the body and mind and the hidden history of the West. But when you read this book, The Final Phase of Empire, Dark Ages America, it's a very sobering treatise on who we are now, where we're going, and what, if anything, can be done about it. Cecil, you have some information here.
Well, Mr. Berman is, as you mentioned, is a well-known cultural historian and social critic. Currently, he is a visiting professor in sociology in the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. And joining us, hopefully, Mr. Berman, are you there?
I am. How are you doing, Cecil?
I am well, and
yes,
thank you for joining us. And you are somewhere in Mexico, I understand?
I am, and I can't tell you how delighted that this phone is working.
I know. Our producer...
Not because of Telmex, incidentally, not because of the Mexican line, which is always good, but I actually have what's called a Vonage phone, which is an American phone number.
Oh, yes.
And the trouble is that it has a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm delighted that there's no... Very frequently there's a time delay of like 3 or 4 seconds, so I sound like I'm reporting from Iran or something like this, you know. I'm happy to say there isn't that this morning.
But, you know, often many of us who imagine ourselves as being authors would just love to be reviewed, have our books reviewed in the New York Times. You got quite a not so what you described as a virulent review by in the New York Times in June, and you responded to it. Why did your book create such a reaction, do you think?
Well, you know, the Times, I mean, despite all the ravings by people like Ann Coulter and Bill O'Reilly, I think at one point Ann Coulter said in a TV interview that she'd like to torch the Times and burn it to the ground. And this was on public television, and there was a sort of uncomfortable laugh by the host, you know. But it said to me something very important. If you're on the right, you can say things like that. Mm-hmm. If you're on the left, you immediately become accused of treason. I mean, can you imagine if I said I wanted the Weekly Standard office burnt down? Mm-hmm. You know. So it's that review had a certain agenda to it. One was that the Times, despite what people like Ann Coulter say, The Times was the agent that led us into the Iraqi war. It published phony stories. That is to say, it didn't know they were phony at the time. They just didn't bother checking it. It published stories. These were done by Judith Miller, mostly, on the front page, day after day, in the 3 months leading up to that invasion. These proved to be phony stories about weapons of mass destruction. She was getting her info from Dick Cheney, who was getting his info from Ahmed Chalabi, who it is suspected was getting his information from Iran. And so stories were planted on the front page. And yes, there were rebuttals, you know, on the op-ed page by Paul Krugman, Frank Rich, and so on. But what Times readers got from that front page was constantly weapons of mass destruction. A year after that, when there were no weapons of mass destruction, on page 10, the Times offered a very short and lukewarm apology to its readers. Not on page 1, but on page 10. So I identify all that in the book. And what Michiko Kakutani, who wrote that review, did was to savage the book without even mentioning its contents. Much of what she said was outright lies, like my evidence was mostly anecdotal. Well, my evidence is mostly statistical. There is some anecdotal evidence, but mostly it's statistical. Things like that. She didn't even mention the contents of the book. And when it was quite obvious by the end of her review what she was after. She wanted it to show that the Times was, quote, objective. That is to say, that Berman was just the left-wing version of Ann Coulter, which wasn't true. I mean, she labeled the book a rant as opposed to being a sober analysis. In fact, her review was the rant, and the book was the sober analysis. I wrote immediately a reply to that review and sent it into the Times. Of course, they didn't publish it. Anybody can find that on my website, which is morrisberman.com. But I have to say that to me it was very significant that not only do they smear an author by writing a fabricated review of a book, I mean a review that's a fabricated version of the book, not only smear the author, they won't let the author defend himself from the smear. So the impression of the book now is total. I can't get it published in foreign countries because those countries read the New York Times, you know, things like this. It largely killed the book, which was the intent.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's very, very significant because the New York Times is the flagship newspaper of the United States. And to have such a lack of objectivity and to be purely emotional and slanderous, to me, took my breath away. And as I said in my letter to the editor, what more evidence do we need when the New York Times does something like this that we are a nation in a state of decline?
You know, had you not said that very last sentence there, I would have asked you, based on your book, part of you, sadly, would not be surprised at this. It has to go, I guess, with some of the main points that you raise in your book when you talk about the fact that, among other things that we have lost, critical thinking seems to be one of them.
Well, I expect that of, let's say, college sophomores, that they wouldn't be able to think, because all the surveys that have been done by the National Education Association, National Education Endowment for the Humanities, National Science Foundation, and so on and so forth, basically show that college students don't know anything. I mean, they can barely read. So if that had happened on the part of college students or the proverbial person on the street, wouldn't be a surprise. But for the New York, you know, Michiko Kakutani is not stupid. And for the Times to do something like this means that in their mind, it's okay, instead of doing a point-by-point rebuttal of my arguments, to just mischaracterize totally the book on an emotional basis and then say this is a piece of garbage. This, to me, says it all, that we have lost any kind of objectivity in this country, and we're running scared. We are running really scared. You talked about compliance a few moments ago.
Yes.
Well, what could be more compliant at the Times than the Times saying to the Bush administration, see, we're not liberal. What could be more compliant? I mean, that's self-censorship.
Self-censorship. To steal a couple of lines from here, your book, you talk about the lack of intellectual suppleness or curiosity and how that we have a society right now that's ignorant of historical context, conditioned to think by the media in terms of sound bites and slogans. And so we take a view of the Bush administration's simple-minded view of the world is sturdy common sense, as if we're harkening back to Teddy Roosevelt age, for example. But it has none of that depth or sturdiness.
Yeah, well, if you're running scared, then a black and white vision of the world makes a lot of sense. I mean, a lot of what I argued in the book is that we can't possibly defeat Al-Qaeda by not understanding who Al-Qaeda is and what they stand for and why they chose to attack the World Trade Center and so on. There's no possibility of winning this war if you really don't get your enemy. Even in World War II, you know, in the United States, one of the most popular books in translation was Hitler's autobiography, Mein Kampf. Americans understood that if they wanted to defeat the enemy, they had to know the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And so they read what he had to say. It was a very popular seller. You can't even, you know, you're looked at cross-eyed these days if you read a copy of the Quran. And so we're in a situation where, running scared, we don't want to know any of the larger issues. What we want to know is that this enemy is absolutely evil, that we're committed to this endless war against them. End of story. This is a really good formula for losing that war.
We're speaking this morning with Morris Berman, who is the author of Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire. And for those of you who are just tuning in, for that matter. Perhaps, Mr. Berman, you can share with the our listeners the thesis of your book and also the origins.
And what was the last part?
The origins of this book.
There really is an interesting question for me because I never intended to write it.
Mm.
It's a sequel to a book I published in 2000, also with Norton.
Twilight.
Called The Twilight of American Culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that book was a surprise also. It just sort of tumbled out of me. And what I was writing it in the mid to late 90s. And basically, the argument of that book was that from an internal point of view, if you look at the structures, the political and social structures of ancient Rome, the Roman Empire, and the late Empire period, and the United States today, you found a number of very disturbing similarities. And the argument was in that book that unless we addressed those things and started to turn them around, there was no way I could see that we would be avoiding a drift into a disintegrating empire kind of model, that we basically had to get on those right away. Well, of course we didn't. I mean, we didn't do anything about those things except make them worse. But in hindsight, after 9/11, that was for me a kind of dramatic moment on a number of levels, as it was for all Americans. But one of the things that occurred to me was, in hindsight, in making that comparison between Rome and the late Empire period in the United States, I had forgotten the most obvious factor, and that was that Rome was invaded.
Yes.
It was attacked from the outside by people it called barbarians. It was drawn into a war of attrition, and it finally lost it. And suddenly I realized this is the most important point of comparison. After all, the last time, who would have thought of it, the last time we were attacked on our own soil was 1814 by the British, who sort of singed the White House a little bit. But this was no singeing. This was really serious. And it meant that a front had opened up, just as it had with the barbarians in Rome, that were intent on taking that empire down and succeeded finally. And I saw that the United States hadn't done the things it needed to do to protect itself. And what happened now was that, in fact, you know, we were invaded. And so within 2 months, I had written the proposal for this sequel, Dark Ages America, because I saw what I had left out. And the most important thing I had left out was, what was the U.S. foreign policy that had precipitated this type of response? I mean, we have to get back past the simplistic notion that I referred to a moment ago, that these people are just pure evil and that's the end of the story. In fact, these people are quite intelligent, they're quite complicated, and they have a particular agenda. And the agenda, in large part, is what Chalmers Johnson calls blowback. Mm-hmm. In other words, for decades in the Middle East, we have been screwing those people over. And you know what? If you do that year in and year out, after a while, they can't get your attention. They're going to get angry. And that's what happened. And in order, therefore, to understand why the World Trade Center was taken down, why this thing occurred, you really had to understand decades of U.S. foreign policy, especially as it applied to the Middle East. So that's what I set out to do in Dark Ages America. Now, it's a lot more than, there are only two chapters about U.S. foreign policy, because a lot of what I do is tie that into the daily values, structures, and behaviors of American citizens that reinforce that policy, what's going on domestically. And in many ways, it's not a contemporary book. That is to say, there, a lot of the argument is that these are very deep structures. Mm-hmm. There's a whole section, for example, on changing value systems in the colonies in the 1790s, which a lot of people wouldn't feel was relevant, but which I saw as inevitably leading to a certain situation.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the Portland metropolitan area, and points east in the Columbia River Gorge, Hood River, Oregon, White Salmon, Washington. It's 91.9, 100.7 in the Willamette Valley. And on the web, it is kboo.fm. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and myself, Celeste, and we're speaking today with author Morris Berman, who has written what I call a very sobering and even a little dark treatise, Dark Ages of America, no pun at all intended, The Final Phase of Empire. And when we talk about it being a bit of a dark treatise, one of the things that you say, and you say unapologetically, is we have already begun that spiral downward. We have already hit that point of no return. There are no levers that can hoist us out of this situation. And you've written this book to at least explain for those who want to hear truth for truth's sake that this is the situation, this is where we're going, and if you care to make something different of it, you might just do best at all by creating an oasis around you, but that's about the best you can hope for on a grand scale.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it does go against the American grain, because we were all raised on Walt Disney and Ralph Waldo Emerson, you know, and the belief that the sun's always going to shine and that things are upbeat and we can always find a solution. I mean, that's kind of the American outlook. And frankly, there are very positive aspects to that Yankee can-do mentality. I mean, I think there are good things about it. But it doesn't make sense in a context when all your options have been bankrupted. Then yes, it's naivete. It's not optimism. It's kind of stupidity. And when in such a situation, it's pessimism that becomes realism. When people say to me, "Oh, surely things can't be that dark. We can turn these things. We can turn all this around." My response to that is, things get turned around because of power. That's how politics works. And there are only two parties that have power, which is to say money, in the United States, one of which is pursuing this war and this agenda, and the other of which is intellectually bankrupt and politically impotent, spineless to boot, and can't do a thing. It's basically reduced to incoherence. So if you want to talk about changing the status quo or moving to a positive place, getting us out of all of this, you have to point to the levers of social change. And I don't want to hear about commondreams.org or moveon.org. I get emails from people saying, "I'm going to organize the bloggers." You know, I say, good luck. Take your best shot. Because the bloggers don't have any money. They don't have any influence, and they don't have any power. And unless you can identify a real political agency that has money and power to move things in another direction, things can only continue to go in the direction that they're going.
Well, you
know, many years ago, Gore Vidal, whom I admire greatly, said, you want to understand American politics? There's one party with two right wings. Mm-hmm. That's how it works.
You know, one of the things that a lot of us like to entertain as the basis of power is the fact that we have community. And yet, in your book, you say community, as we understand it, has been disassembled, and we are actually anti-community. Before we get into your comments on that, I'd like to speak to our KBOO listeners who are not yet members and ask you, are you antithetical to community? Are you a community buster, or are you somebody who is a community trust holder and a community builder? And to encourage you to recognize and realize that potential within yourself to turn around the trend that we're discussing here, that Morris Berman has laid out for us, to say, yes, I do see an entity, I do see an agency that has power, has the will to make the difference, and will put its money where its mouth is. And so we're asking you as KBOO listeners to become members and to make a difference. There are not very many corporately owned and controlled radio stations that will bring you this kind of information. We're speaking with someone who had the fortitude to publish a book that says, this is where we're going wrong in America, if you care to listen. And our flagship newspaper decided that I'm not going to listen, and I'm going to discourage anybody else from listening, because I want them to have that same ostrich-like, you know, outlook on world. Not very much.
Mr. Berman has is committed to building community, and we have through his generosity and his publisher, copies of this book for those of you who would like to become members of KBOO. Celeste mentioned to Mr. Berman the fact that our notion of community has changed, and what you do in this book is give us an overarching view of American history, American culture. And one thing that you key upon, that Celeste touched upon, was the notion of community.
And the disintegration of it, because it would be the basis for the power for the change that you mentioned. Community has long been considered the major change agent. You get that little knot of determined people, and we've been told a group of determined, positive people can accomplish anything. But it seems that critical mass is missing.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. People are either frightened or cynical, and they're certainly disintegrated and not talking to each other. The data on the collapse of community is not my research. I mean, I didn't go out and do the sociological research. There are a number of scholars who did that, most notably Robert Putnam at Harvard,
Bowling
who
Alone.
Did a book in 2000 called Bowling Alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about that book in my book, where basically Putnam goes through the data of all kinds of surveys, questionnaires, an enormous statistical database that he has doing research with a large graduate student team over the years, to show that Americans don't trust each other anymore. They don't invite each other to each other's houses. They don't talk to their neighbors. They don't know who their neighbors are. I lived for years in Washington, D.C., in what had to be one of the most alienating environments I've ever lived in, where, I've said that if it was any more hostile, it would have been Bosnia. It's quite breathtaking to see how from, let's say, the period of 1965 to 1995, the country completely turned around. The data on church groups, people inviting each other over to play bridge, all that sort of thing that involves human interaction, just evaporated in the United States. And so now we have hostile, alienated, and, as you said, very compliant people who just want to be left alone. I mean, that's agenda number one. And to me, that's one of the saddest things I can imagine that could happen to a nation, because, in a sense, it's the end of that nation.
Yes.
One thing, when we talk about community, people often look for people of similar interests, similar similar goals. One thing that you do in this book is talk about different types of community, and specifically I'm talking about, say, Christian fundamentalism, the contrast between secular and tribal. Say something about the role of religion in American society and how it interacts in the situation we are in today.
Yeah, I mean, that's an important shift that happened in the United States. Again, when I did the research on this, I mean, I was frankly blown away by what I found about lack of community and lack of basic, you know, information about American history or institutions and that sort of thing. But the data on, I mean, I one of the things I say was that in the twilight of American culture, I was talking about twilight, now I'm talking about night. If twilight was the late Roman Empire, now we're talking about early Middle Ages, and one of the most distinguishing characteristics, of course, of the early Middle Ages was the triumph of religion over reason, which, you know, has been documented pretty thoroughly by medieval scholars. And we have now a situation in which the majority, for example, in this country believe in the biblical version of creation. 47% think that the human race is not more than 10,000 years old. 59% believe in the apocalypse and the rapture, and that Christ is going to return in this lifetime to separate the good from the evil and all this sort of thing. We have a president that is dedicated to what he calls a faith-based foreign policy. You see the results of this faith-based foreign policy. It's in the newspaper every day. And the type of thing, you know, I mean, Thomas Jefferson put it very well. He said, no nation can be both ignorant and free. If you're walking around in a fog of, you know, the apocalypse and that Darwin was wrong and so on, in short, if you're out of touch with reality, what could you do except produce scenarios like Iraq? What do you think is going to happen if you're out of touch with reality? This is very, in a strange way, echoes that kind of anti-Darwinian campaign in the Soviet Union in the 30s, where they opted for Lamarck instead of Darwin in terms of raising wheat, and there was a huge wheat failure and a huge famine across the land. The person, the scientist that who was Lamarckian, was called Lysenko. Mm-hmm. And this was just an example of that. You cannot operate successfully in the world out of touch with reality. And that's what we have slipped into now. And, you know, although, I mean, I discuss in the book, Frank Rich also does in his New York Times op-ed writer, in his recent book, The Greatest Story Ever Sold, that a few years ago, the New York Times reporter Ron Suskind interviewed Bush policy advisors, and they told him that he was living in, quote, the reality-based community, where solutions emerge from judicious study. And the point they were making was that this was bad. In other words, one senior advisor, it was probably Karl Rove, told Suskind, that's not the way the world works anymore. We're an empire now. When we act, we create our own reality.
Our own reality.
Well,
yes.
As I, you know, enjoy saying when I'm giving public talks about this, I always think of that line from Dr. Phil. How's that working for you?
Well, given the fact that we're a rogue nation now with very few friends, and the friends we have, sometimes we're selling the enemies of our friends' weapons, I don't think it's working that well for us.
No. Well, I mean, the evidence is there. The question is when the United States is going to wake up. And my argument in the book is that it's not. There's not, you know, there has been no empire in historical record that in its declining years, when it was hollowing out everything it believed in, and basically the economic base was eroding, you know, every day and so on, suddenly looked at what it was doing and said, oh no, this is not good. We're gonna reverse direction. There's not a single case of that happening in history, and I don't believe that the United States, which is very, very, very religiously oriented, especially around the notion of the United States, is going to suddenly wake up and say, "Let's reverse gears." This cannot. I mean, that would be a miracle, and I don't believe in them. So, I think we're in a situation where downhill slide is the future scenario.
We're speaking this morning with Morris Berman, the author of Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire. And if you have a question or comment for Mr. Berman, give us a call at
503-231-8187. But don't pass go. Be sure to call in to our membership central as well. If you're outside of the Portland area, it's 1-877-500-5266. If you're in the city, it's 503-232-8818.
As you mentioned, you compare the where America is today to I think you just mentioned the early Middle Ages. I think also in your book you talk about in terms of comparison what's happening in our world today with what happens at that point in time. And you talk about, for lack of a better term, someone else came up with the phrase the class of civilization. Say something about where we are in terms of the West versus Islam. Is it repetitive of something that happened before, and what lessons can we learn from history?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Clash of Civilizations was the title, part of the title of an article and then a book by Samuel Huntington at Harvard that became very famous because it certainly looked on 9/11 that what we had is a clash of civilizations. The trouble is, I spend a lot of time in the book talking about Islamic-Christian differences, but the real problem with Huntington's argument, which oddly enough he admits in the book and therefore winds up contradicting himself, is that what he really wants to say, his major argument, is that this is an essentialist difference. That is to say that the Islamic nations hark back to Saladin and their opposition to the Crusades, the heroic days of Islam, the 7th century, the 10th and 11th centuries, and so on and so forth. And that what we're coming up against is a fundamental difference in belief outlook, and that's what's risen to the surface. But, as he himself finally winds up admitting, and I think most critics of the book have shown, the objection of Islam to the West is really a few decades old. I mean, the serious objection. It's not... If you go through the list of grievances, for example, that Osama bin Laden has given against the United States, and most Americans are not allowed to find this out, when Osama bin Laden gives a talk to the American people, what happens is that the American press just publishes a couple of sentences and then does a large spin on what a whack job he is. As I said, we had the full text of what Hitler said all the time in World War II. That helped a whole lot. We don't have that for bin Laden, unless you go to the Al Jazeera website. Then you get the full text in English. His grievances are not about, for the most part, are not about ancient historical ones. They are about the fact that after the Gulf War in 1991, American troops said they were going to stay for 6 months, and they stayed for 12 years, positioning themselves very close to the holy sites of Mecca and Medina. Or that the United States gives a few hundred grand every year, whatever it is, maybe $400 million, something like that, to the Palestinians, and $3 billion to the Israelis, which enables the Israelis to buy missiles to blow up residential areas of Gaza. One after another, the complaints that Osama lists are recent. They are really post-World War II. And so the notion that there's an inherent clash, I think, is very misguided. There are some inherent differences, but historically, Jews, Arabs, and Christians have gotten along in lots of societies. They have rubbed shoulders, worked well enough together. What we did was have a foreign policy that essentially was dedicated to damaging the Islamic community, to undermining them. And this has been going on for a very long time. And when you do that, you don't get a clash of civilizations. You get rage. If the same thing had been done to us by the Islamic nations, which only surfaced on 9/11, what was our response? Was our response, let's sit down and talk? It was, no, we're going to blow you out of the water. Well, that's what they've been feeling for several decades.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. This is an opportunity to speak with the author of Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire, Morris Berman. We do have a caller online. Good morning. You are on the air.
Oh, Mr. Berman. Hello?
Yes, you are.
I'm listening to you.
Okay. Yeah, unfortunately, I haven't read your book, but I would say that I heard your remark that in the Middle Ages, you said that Western civilization chose religion over reason. And I guess the comment that I might make is that the problem with particularly the American version of Christianity is they haven't really read the scripture close enough. They read parts of it and make conclusions, but they don't really read the whole thing. And I think we're in Western culture, where it was read more closely was during the what we call the Great Awakening, with the Methodist movement and the beginning of
Transcendentalists.
Huh?
And the Transcendentalists.
I don't know anything about that, but
Emerson and that whole crowd.
I know that early Christianity was a movement of working people, and if you read the scripture closely, St. Paul, for example, says, "We apostles," and by that he means the closest followers of Christ. He says, "We work with our hands so that we would not be a burden to anyone and to be an example that you should follow." So there was that truth to it, that in the formation of Christianity, and this is probably where it was a great reformation to the Judaic tradition, that they recognized that to have a society free of conflict, you had to have people that actually produce something of value, because people are always going to desire value, a material value, unless they become so, unless they really go over to a completely spiritual view of life. I think, like the Hindu mystics, maybe they've gone over to a completely spiritual view. But if you still want a material value, they have to be people that actually produce that.
Okay.
Otherwise, there's going to be fighting and squabbling over that value. So, in early Christianity, that was the emphasis, to be people that actually worked and produced something, and
okay. Okay.
But then there were other aspects of not being overcome by various passions of the flesh that could destroy people.
Okay, well, thank you, caller, and we do have to continue on. But one thing that I did glean from his call is something that you do address in the book, is in terms of the notion of work and what is value. You mentioned in your book how that has changed, and you talk about the 90s when what is produced is ideas as opposed to things we do with our hands.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot written about. I talk about virtual bread making shops where mm-hmm. the bakers don't even touch any dough. It's all little icons on screens and things like that. And basically the decline of the craft tradition. Historically, I think the caller is wrong, though, in saying that this was a rupture of Judaism. Judaism always emphasized that there was an important craft tradition, and basically every father was supposed to teach a son, for example, not only to be a scholar or to study, but also to have a craft, to have a trade. So I'm not sure that that works as an analysis myself, but certainly in recent times, we have a society that's increasingly abstract.
We're speaking this morning with Morris Berman, author of Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire, and you are listening to KBOO Portland.
And we do have a couple of people on board here, so let's go to our callers. Good morning, you're on the air.
Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning.
And good morning, Cecil, and good morning, Mr. Berman. Mr. Berman, I have a copy of your book, The Twilight of the American Culture, and this is a very important topic. Can you hear me?
I can.
Hey, I'm sorry. Well, I have a comment, a question, if I may.
Yes.
The comment is this, and I hope you understand where I'm coming from, Morris Berman. I have said for a number of years now that we are living in an AIDS-related cultural dark age because so many artists, musicians, actors, writers, and so forth who could have become something were laid waste in the 1980s in our country. And the question I have is, what role does practically institutional racism play in our tragic decline? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much for being with us, Morris Berman, and I sure do love to hear those calls from West Lynn with new listener members. Thank you.
Okay. So the question was, well, I don't know how we're going to get from institutional racism to orchestras and, you know, musical organizations and things like this, but certainly, racism is very palpable in the United States. I think myself it goes both ways, but we're in a situation where I think, you know, there was a phrase that was once applied to, maybe still is, I lived in Quebec for many years, was applied to the situation between French speakers and Anglophones in Quebec, and it was the phrase was the two solitudes. That's how Canadian society has been described, and I think it applies to American society as well. We've got, along racial lines, two solitudes, communities that don't really interact with each other, one of which, of course, is at a great economic disadvantage. I can't imagine that that's not having an enormous corroding influence on the United States. One thing I talk about in the Twilight book is I worked as a tutor for some months in the inner city in Washington, D.C., and I have to tell you, it was an all-black school, and it was very dispiriting to me because, what had happened to these kids, what had happened to them? One thing was they not only didn't know basic facts about just the world, you know. For example, most of them had never heard of the Atlantic Ocean. We were less than 100 miles from the Atlantic Ocean. They'd never heard of it. And I can give you, you know, one example after another. I tried a lot of times not to gasp when I was teaching, you know. But the way I think that that community was really defeated that I saw was there was a lack of spirit. In other words, they felt that they were excluded from the so-called American dream, and they didn't know how they were going to get access to it, you know. And so there was a crushing of the spirit that I saw that was very depressing. These are the types of things that cripple a nation. They really cripple a nation. And I don't know how it surfaces in terms of orchestras or something like this, but certainly if you have that kind of bitterness, that kind of divide, and the feeling of a large part of the population that they're not privy to, they don't have access to what other parts of the population do, that's just the slow erosion of values and purpose. I think that's part of the scenario as well.
Yes. Thank you. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, caller, and thank you for waiting.
Oh, yes, thank you. I have not had the opportunity to read your book. It sounds very, very telling, very reflective, very important in these times. And I think the parallel with perhaps with the Roman Empire and this the collapse is apropos. And the fact that we have the barbarians at the gates, as it were, the parallels you've drawn in the relation, the mention of Clash of Cultures and the Hunting the Book. I would submit that this, along with Brzezinski's Grand Chessboard and the document, the famous document from the Project for the New American Century, these three together have allowed for the promotion of this notion that they've used to launch this horrible war, this Islamo-fascist terrorism, this myth of Islamo-fascist terrorism. You mentioned bin Laden and all the things he said, and I've heard it said before that he was the perfect bogeyman for this. He perfectly replaced the him and this axis of evil, perfectly replaced the evil empire that we were previously fighting. And I'm just wondering if you could comment on the parallel of all of this related to, for example, the need to develop this Gladio network in Europe in the 50s, 60s, and 70s to fight the communists. Now we have Al-Qaeda, and it's pretty well documented that this Al-Qaeda bogeyman it grew out of the Mujahideen, and it's been set up and pretty much perpetrated, funded, trained by the CIA, MI6, and I think people really need to be made aware of this, because at the end of your argument, when you talk about bin Laden, then you talk about 9/11, and you take the same position that many, many people take, this blowback position, and I think it has a tendency to reinforce what the regime is trying to achieve, which is really a complete failure and collapse in terms of what we should be doing. But then again, maybe it's fated and there is no way out. People who would like to have, who recognize this and say what we need is real shock therapy if we're going to turn around, and these are people in the 9/11 truth movement, they claiming the shock of 9/11 truth is what is required if we're going to turn this around at all. And the people who refuse to get on board because it's the political and journalistic third rail are really just perpetuating the nightmare. So that's what I'd like you to address, if you could, please.
Well, I can try, but we need about 2 hours.
Yeah, well, we don't have quite that much, so the short version,
right,
if you can.
Right. But, I mean, there are a lot of things that you raised. The most important thing I would say about what you raised is that there's a lot of hidden material that actually is out there. I mean, you know, I mean, I did the research and dug it up. I don't have a Q classification, security clearance at the Pentagon. Any American can dig this material up. As far as you mentioned Project for a New American Century, I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time. They're listed in the phone book. I called them up. I said, I understand you have a pamphlet called Rebuilding America's Defenses. Could you send it to me? They said, fine. 2 days later, it was in my mailbox. No big deal. It's about 90 pages long, and there it is. It says specifically that what we've got to do is get control of the Middle East. Saddam Hussein is basically a pretext for this. It wouldn't matter who's running the country. The idea is geopolitical control. However, there is no appetite on the part of the American people for a war with Iraq, and therefore what we are waiting for is a new Pearl Harbor. It's right in there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that has led that 9/11 truth movement to start arguing that it was an inside job. That is to say that it was the United States that blew up the World Trade Center and so on and so forth, so that Cheney and his pals could essentially, the people that wrote that document, could essentially say, right, see, now we need a war against Iraq, and they could fulfill their agenda. Personally, I have to say I don't believe in the conspiracy theory, because I think there was enough hatred out there toward the United States to bring down the World Trade Center without it being an inside job. But what we really have to look at is the source of that rage, the source of that anger, and that's the one thing that basically journalists don't want to touch. That's the third rail. It's also the case that when you refer to taking over from our rabid anti-communism, now we're into a rabid anti-terrorism or anti-Islamism, whatever one would call it, the United States does have a history from the beginning. After all, it defined itself as being not British and not European, and that was a big part of the revolution. It has a history of defining itself not by what it is, but by what it's not.
Right.
That creates a kind of vacuum at the center. And for a very long time, we had the ability to say, well, we're not communists. And everything, foreign policy and domestic policy, were all organized around not being communists. That fell apart in 1989 to 91. And that's why the Clinton years were the Seinfeld years, a show about nothing. Clinton wasn't about anything at all. Globaloney. I mean, that, you know, to grow the economy. What did he stand for? And so when 9/11 came along, all of a sudden, there it was. I don't believe we created that myself. I don't believe the conspiracy theory. But boy, it was a gift on the platter to this administration and the American military. No question about that. And so now terrorism replaces communism. We have the ultimate evil all over again, and we're set to run this out for the next 100 years, which I suspect we will.
Well, as long as the empire lasts and the finances hold up, so to speak.
Right, right.
Yeah, because given the fact that we're careening toward insolvency, you know, as we speak, I don't know that we can hold out another 100 years at this rate. But I want to ask you a question here.
That's true.
Given the fact that you don't see any change agents today, you don't think that the well, you think the Democratic Party is politically and intellectually bankrupt, and that the Greens are not a strong force on this side of the Atlantic, and any claim of a dynamic grassroots movement or a radical middle of our society doesn't really exist. I'd like to ask what you see as a mitigating force for many people, even though some of the ways that faith is manifested these days is much the same as our soundbite historical and intellectual attitudes. For many people, there is the mitigating force. Rather a faith that when elevated, we do good things, so to speak. It's one of the things that can draw us together and create a community. It's the thing that has allowed us in many times to establish a global relationship and see each other as brothers and sisters and to look beyond tribal confines. But you don't seem to be very optimistic in faith as a mitigating force.
No, because I mean, it's all good to have those types of intentions,
mm-hmm.
but if faith in that direction is going to work, it has to be tied to sources of power. And right now,
uh-huh.
faith in the United States is tied to a source of power. It's called right-wing Christian fundamentalism.
It's been corrupted and co-opted, and so there's no longer any mitigating ability from your perspective.
No, I mean, those uh-huh. people of goodwill, those people of faith who are of goodwill, do not have access to power and money. They just don't have it. And that's how politics works. If you want to get the U.S. off of this self-destructive course, you've got to be able to grab the reins of power. That is not going to happen.
not as we manifest it now. So they're basically, even the politically astute and able still don't have that opportunity, is what I'm hearing you say. The fact that those who are idly fiddling while everything burns have the reins of power, the rest of us are going to go down that road as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure they're that idle either. I'm sure aggressively working toward
yes.
their aggrandizement and thereby the destruction of the United States.
Before we let you go, perhaps you can tell us in terms of the type of reception you are getting from your book, and in terms of, for example, your students, what things are you telling them about the future?
Students sometimes say, well, you know, I'm 21 years old or I'm 20 years old. What should I do? And I say things to them like, look, I'm going to be honest with you, and I'm going to say things you don't want to hear. Move to Europe.
Or Canada.
Right. What do you think you have to look forward to 40 years from now when you're old and you're getting sick? Do you think there's going to be a medical plan in this country that protects you? Do you think Social Security, seriously, is still going to exist? Do you think there's going to be a social safety net or a community or a purpose? We are following the model of Rome, where we are spending hundreds of billions on frivolous military exercises. There will be no domestic protection for you, and your taxes will simply go to fund the murder of innocent civilians abroad. Why would you want to participate on it? I say, when you graduate, go to graduate school in Europe, get your equivalent green card there, learn whatever language you need to learn, and get a job. Come back Christmas time and see your relatives, see how worried they are, see the lines in their faces, see how scared they are about everything, economy, war, and so on. Spend a week with that, and then go back to a reasonable place.
You know, we're going to have to invite you back, because what I want to ask you now is to kind of compare and contrast your attitude that basically is bringing us this news, that has done the study, with where your head was when you wrote Reenchantment of the World, or Body and Spirit in the Hidden History of the West. Because I sense what has been kind of a darkening of your optimism. And
Except that, Celeste, with one important qualification. The series that I did on the evolution of human consciousness,
right,
Reenchantment of the World, Coming
mm-hmm.
to Our Senses, and Wandering God, are about civilization in general. And
right.
In terms of the human spirit, I remain very optimistic.
Good.
But the United States is a very small part of the world.
Yes,
it's only 6% of the landmass. It's only been around for 230 years. I mean, 6% of the population. It's a small part of the landmass. And it's only been around for 230 years. It will rise and it will fall. And you know what? The world will go on without it.
And perhaps
so,
those of us who
have
consciousness.
You know, let's not get fixated on the United States. It's just a small part of the world, and it's a small part of world history. So finally, I stand by what I wrote in those other works, that there is a future for the human spirit.
Good.
But that future does not exist on the American soil, anymore. That's over.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us, and we hope to continue our conversation with you as we explore not only the future of America, but where the human humanity,
the brightening of the human spirit.
Is heading.
Listen, I appreciate the invitation, and I'll be delighted to talk on those topics anytime.
Great, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
We're speaking with. Goodbye. We've been speaking with Morris Berman, the author of Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire, a book that the New York Times does not want you to read.
Doesn't want you to read it.
However, here at KBOO,
we're encouraging you
to read it.
You have become the consummate
Dr. Nine, I'm back.
Have you secured the media outlet for the 900 Club's inaugural broadcast, Schlichtenstein?
Yes, Doctor. Monday, October 30th at 11 p.m. on KBOO during a radio theater show called The Southern Radio Project.
You diminutive dummy!
Ow!
Radio theater? Community radio? Monday night at 11? You might as well be entering the Barry Manilow Marathon.
But, Doctor, if your nine wave can penetrate the cultured, independent minds of the KBOO radio theater audience, listeners to enter PRCOM channel stations will be easy pickings.
You're right, Schlichtenstein. This is merely phase one of Plan 9 from Uber Space. The Southern Radio broadcast on Monday, October 30th at 11 p.m. will make the Exorcist look like Pippi Longstockings. A Halloween horror show written, produced, and directed by...
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice, activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org.